From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a second term for Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan.
I think, like for most incumbents, this was always the mayor's to lose.
Flint Mayor Karen Weaver wins in a recall vote against 17 challengers.
I think if there was a surprise, it was the fact that she drew more than 50% of the vote.
Teachers take their fight with the governor over withheld wages to the Michigan Supreme Court.
You know, teachers aren't making a ton of money to begin with, and this money means something to them.
Murray Howe talks about his dad, hockey legend Gordie Howe.
Humble, for sure, generous, gracious, courageous, loving, unstoppable.
And Michigan's Indian boarding schools.
The term used was to become civilized, and civilized meant that you were Christian, that you went to school, and that you farmed.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Coming up later this hour, Murray Howe gives us a sun's eie view of NHL legend Gordie Howe.
As I realized how special he was after he passed, I really wanted to share that with the rest of the world to keep his spirit going and his legacy of love.
But first, the off-year election of 2017 is in the history books. Now the winners can get on with the job of fulfilling their campaign promises. In Detroit, voters gave Mayor Mike Duggan a second term and rejected a challenge from Coleman Young II. Detroit Free Press editorial writer Nancy Kaffer is with us. Now, Mike Duggan won in a landslide, what, more than 70% of the vote. Was this more a case of Mike Duggan winning this or Coleman Young II losing?
Well, I think like for most incumbents, this was always the mayor's to lose, not the challenger's to win. I mean, you have an incumbent who has done a lot of the stuff he said he would, and I think that there was a chance that he could have been given a better run for his money by a different candidate. Senator Young did not run that campaign, and the mayor ran a good campaign. That being said, you know, a pretty small number of people came out to vote, which everyone will read their own tea leaves into. Some folks will say, well, if you didn't get out and vote, then that must mean you're pretty content with how things are going. And other folks will say, if you didn't get out and vote, it means you're not engaged at all in the process and don't even feel like your vote matters. And they're probably all right. There are probably people who feel that way, both of those ways.
What are the to-dos for him now? What needs to happen in his second term?
Well, he needs to, you know, he said that he believes that people have had confidence in him because they can look at neighborhoods where they've seen progress happen, where their friends or their cousins or their acquaintances live, and they've seen more work happening, and that folks could have confidence that the city is coming to help them. That is a thing he has to make good on. He has to extend this work to other parts of the city. And he also has to get pretty serious about accountability. They continue to be dogged by questions about the demolitions program. There are ongoing investigations into that program. This is obviously a very sore spot, irregularity or question about the way contracts are awarded. This is unfortunately the thing that every politician elected in the post-Kwame Kilpatrick era will sort of struggle under the shadow for a while. Any kind of irregularity around the awarding of contracts is going to draw a lot of questions, and it should. This is something that the mayor has said that some of the land bank practices were not well conceived, and they've changed them. But you know, we really have to be very clear going forward about what is and isn't happening, you know, what deals are being made, what processes are. That's something the Detroiters deserve.
Looking at city council races, one I wanted to get your thoughts on was District 6 council member Raquel Castaneda Lopez. A super PAC tied to the Maroon family, spent a lot of money trying to get her unelected. They were supporting her challenger, and she was reelected. So how would you characterize the Maroon family's hold on Detroit's levers of power on this day after the election?
Well, it was very close. I mean, that was not a slam dunk by any means. You know, the Maroon family, Councilmember Castaneda Lopez has been very outspoken about a lot of sort of status quo things. She's pushed back for her district on a lot of questions about how tax dollars are funding. I mean, this is not necessarily related to the Maroons, but how tax dollars are being used to fund big business projects. She's pushed back on the bridge that the Maroon family is trying to build. She's been very outspoken, and if you're a Maroon, I can see why that would not be what you want. But, you know, this is the second time the Maroons have spent a lot of money and not won. If you recall, I think it was 2012, there was that proposal to try to invoke statewide approval for any international bridge crossing, which was clearly aimed at shutting down a publicly built bridge to Canada. Didn't work. They spent sort of an obscene amount of money on that. I mean, money certainly gives people a leg up in politics, but I think we've seen a couple of times it's not the only factor, which is pretty heartening, really.
Overall, big takeaways for city council races, incumbents versus new faces.
Well, this has been one of the most sort of uneventful councils we've had impaneled in a while. And, you know, you've been covering this stuff for a while. You know that previous councils have provided a lot more fodder for headlines with personal behavior or antics at the table. And this council has been pretty unremarkable in that way. There's been a lot of collegial coalition building to support, you know, various things that have come up. There hasn't been anything real crazy that's happened in session. There have been a couple people who've had some personal problems. One of them, incumbent George Cushingberry, was the only person who got unseated. And yeah, so this has been a council most folks just, I guess, clearly don't have any real problems with, and so almost everyone got returned to their seats.
In our final few seconds, the race for city clerk certainly drew a lot of attention because of a lot of problems in Detroit during the presidential election last year. But Janice Winfrey squeaked out a win over challenger Garland Gilchrist. What are your thoughts?
That was the real nail-biter. That was the race that I think most people were watching most avidly. A lot of folks didn't expect him to make it out of the primary. He did, and then, you know, ran a very strong campaign. He's a really exciting young man who has a lot of really interesting ideas, ways to use social media and technology to improve voter turnout in Detroit, which is abysmal. I think a lot of, especially young Detroiters, were really excited about him, and a lot of people are very crushed this morning that he didn't win. It was very close. Clerk Winfrey, you know, I think a lot of folks don't remember what the situation in the clerk's office was when she was elected in 2005. Jackie Curry, who had been clerk, ran a very unsatisfactory department. When she got unelected, it was when Winfrey won. And she has done a lot to restore credibility to the office, but I think a lot of folks don't remember what she took over. We've got a lot of people who just haven't been in the city that long, and they discount what she's done. Now, our paper endorsed Gilchrist because we felt like that she had done a lot, but that it was time to let someone else take the wheel. Detroit voters disagreed, very narrowly disagreed. But we really hope that the clerk takes some of Gilchrist's ideas and implements them. I mean, he had really sharp ideas, and, you know, I think that the clerk is a good person who cares about her job, and I hope that she's looking for the best ideas from all quarters.
Nancy Caffer, Detroit Free Press, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We turn to election results in Flint, and with us now, Michigan Radio's Steve Carmody. Mayor Karen Weaver won with a majority of the vote in this big recall election. Was it a surprise at all?
I don't know if it was a complete surprise. With 17 challengers in a recall election, the advantage to some extent goes to the incumbent. I think if there was a surprise, it was the fact that she drew more than 50% of the vote.
So that was a resounding yes for Mayor Karen Weaver.
I don't know if resounding is the best word to use. It was definitely a win. Her critics can't say that she doesn't have the support of the majority of the people who voted.
Now, remind us again, Steve, what her opponent said were the reasons behind this recall.
Well, there were many things that people brought up during the recall campaign, but the actual recall itself was based on Weaver's attempt to change the company that picks up Flint's trash. And she wanted to hire a company that does most of its work out of Southeast Michigan. Now, the thing is, that company, Rizzo Environmental Services, is tied up in a corruption scandal, something that she did not know apparently at the time when she proposed hiring Rizzo. But once it came out that Rizzo was under investigation by the federal government, she dropped her support for the company. But that has been one of those things that just continued to kind of percolate in Flint politics and, again, was the reason why the recall petition was circulated.
There's going to be a big turnover in the Flint City Council, with 5 of the 9 seats being filled by new faces. And this includes a 19-year-old named Santino Guerra, who defeated the council president, Kerry Nelson. How'd that happen?
Well, it's one of those things. When you're talking about a city ward election, you're talking about really the opinion of several hundred people in one part of the city. It's one of those things that sometimes people are very, you know, including young people, are very effective in making connections with voters. Mr. Guerra definitely was able to do that against an incumbent and, again, the city council president.
What does this turnover in the council mean for Flint and for Mayor Weaver's agenda going forward?
Well, it's a big help for her agenda, probably. The five members of the city council who will not be part of the new council that's sworn in next week were opponents of her policies, and some of them leading opponents, including Scott Kincaid, who ran against her and lost in the recall election. So at this point, there are three people on the council who you can count on as being no votes for her agenda. There's one who's a firm Weaver backer, but then the other five who are coming in, they're new, and it's unclear how they're going to set themselves up on many issues facing the city, including what to do about the city's long-term drinking water needs.
To that point, Steve, here we see a voter turnout. I'm seeing figures of about 17%, about 14,400 registered voters.
Yes, and that's a bit on the high end of what was expected. I heard a range expected between 12 and 15%. So, you know, that is better than what most people were expecting.
But 17%, and when you think of everything that has happened in the city of Flint, especially with decisions made by unelected leaders, what, if anything, do you think we can take away from such a low turnout?
Again, it's a low turnout. It is an off-year election. There weren't any major statewide or national offices on the ballot. Normally, you have a low turnout for this type of election. And even though it's only 17%, and that is a low turnout, by Flint standards for an off-year election, it's actually higher than normal. So I think that there is interest. I think that, you know, obviously you would prefer to have more of the other 83% of registered voters who didn't turn out to vote actually vote. But I think it is a little bit better than what it would have been normally.
Election day itself, things go smoothly as far as the mechanics of getting votes in and counted?
Well, in the past in Flint, you normally expect a very late night because of problems with election equipment. But the tally was done well before 9 p.m. So that was very, very fast and credited mainly to the new equipment that the city and many other cities around the state of Michigan are now using.
Michigan Radio's Steve Carmody with The View from Flint. Thanks so much, Steve.
My pleasure.
Still to come, new music from Michigan singer-songwriter Joshua Davis.
It's kind of about finding the beauty in the ordinary and finding those kind of rhythms in your life as you get to past your 20s and into your 30s and stuff where you're kind of finding a rhythm and it's about finding the sweetness in there.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the Michigan Supreme Court hears oral arguments in a long legal battle between the state and a large group of public school employee unions. The spotlight shines on a 2010 law that dates back to the Granholm administration. This law required public school employees to contribute 3% of their salaries for retiree health care. And even though that practice has ended, the money paid from the summer of 2010 till January 2013 is sitting in an escrow account that now tops $550 million. Governor Snyder wants that money for the state. The unions want it given back to teachers and school employees. Emily Lawler of MLive is with us now. This is a pretty complicated history here, Emily. Let's see if we can break it down, get us all up to speed. It all started in 2010. When this coalition of school employee unions sued over the state's withholding of 3% of their pay for retirement health care benefits. What was then Governor Granholm's rationale for collecting this money?
You know, funding retirement organizations and municipalities across the state are struggling with this even still today. But retiree health care was really a rising cost and something that the state felt a need to rein in at some level. And for teachers, they asked for a 3% contribution to go toward retiree health care.
So how much money are we talking about roughly per each person affected?
You know, you can do the mental math on 3% of an average teacher's salary, but the amount of money right now that's in this escrow fund that has been collected, teachers say they want it, the state wants it for their retirement, is $550 million. So you know, all that money from all these school employees really adds up.
So it could possibly mean if a school employee was to get something back, we could be talking thousands.
Oh, absolutely. For the average teacher, I think this money is meaningful. It makes a difference. And that's been a main talking point of the MEA and the AFT, the teachers unions in this case, is that, teachers aren't making a ton of money to begin with, and this money means something to them.
So in 2016, the Court of Appeals decision ruled in favor of the school employees that the money should be returned. So what was the argument that won over the judges there?
Absolutely. The argument that won over was that it was unconstitutional. There are several clauses of the Constitution. They pointed to the Contracts Clause, the Takings Clause. The judges agreed that at that time that the 2010 law was unconstitutional.
So at that point, Attorney General Bill Schuette decided, all right, I'm out. He decided not to pursue the case any further. Why not?
Yeah, interesting move by Attorney General Bill Schuette. He had run it for 6 years at that point. It started in 2010. He was appealing, and at some point after the 2016 ruling, said, you know what, no more. And Governor Snyder responded by hiring a private attorney and a private law firm to take it all the way.
So Governor Snyder's deciding, all right, I'm going along with private attorneys to appeal this. Why do we think he wanted to do that even when the AG chose not to?
You know, I would say that the governor is consummately a numbers man. He's looking at the bottom line. Other state employees do have this kind of 3% contribution toward retiree health care. I think that for him, it's a matter of fairness, of fiscal stability. $550 million is not insignificant in terms of the budget. And also in terms of what these teachers are going to need in their later years after retirement.
And as you said, Emily, the governor hired private attorneys to keep this appeal going. And you wrote about this over the summer on MLive. As of that point, 4 months ago, how much are these private attorneys costing taxpayers?
Yeah, over $100,000. The governor specifically had cost $108,000 at that time, but the attorney general had also initially used some outside attorneys that pushed it up over $180,000. For the lifetime of this case, I imagine that going back to the Supreme Court could result in even more cost to the taxpayers.
All right, everybody, hang on, because this is where it gets convoluted. So lawmakers passed a law in 2012 to try to replace and fix the problems with that 2010 Granholm era law, the one that resulted in that $550 million being withheld between 2010 and 2012. So the Supreme Court upheld this new 2012 law. Why are they just now getting to the older law, the one from 2010?
So 2012 law is great. It has passed muster, at least legally. But the Supreme Court, when it ruled that the 2012 law was good to go, basically remanded the case on the 2010 law to the Court of Appeals to consider whether the 2012 law had succeeded in undoing all the unconstitutional portions of the 2010 law. So the question at this point is kind of whether that money that was collected under an unconstitutional law should go back to the teachers or should go towards the place it was intended for their retirement.
So there's really where we're at with this Supreme Court taking this up now, trying to just unpick this. And as you say, over $500 million, big money for the state and certainly big money for those school employees.
You know, on a personal level, a lot of these school employees are, looking at $2,000-$3,000 maybe sitting out there and saying, why isn't that money in my pocket? And why hasn't it been since 2010?
And didn't I see in your piece from earlier this summer for MLive that even the organization's lead plaintiff in the case died? So you've had people dying who've been part of this.
You know, there are people who won't get justice, and the lead plaintiff is an example of that. People who, even if this case prevails, even if the unconstitutional law that this money was collected under, the court decides that that was proper or improper, and this money goes back to people, there are people who will never get that money back.
MLive's Emily Lawler, thank you for sorting this out for us as best we can. It certainly is a complicated case.
Thank you.
That day when my roommate had you over for a while, cool and sweet in the summer heat, green eyes and a crooked smile. You were reading Dante, I tried to play cool. Honey, you left me out of breath, I sounded like a fool. All these memories
That's Michigan singer-songwriter Joshua Davis with a track from his new studio album, The Way Back Home. The album comes some 2.5 years after NBC's The Voice introduced the rest of America to Joshua, who had already built a very sturdy fan base throughout his home state of Michigan. And Joshua Davis is here with us now. Pleasure to welcome you to Stateside, Joshua.
Thanks so much, Cynthia. It's great to be here.
Your first studio album in, 4.5 years? A lot of water under the bridge since then.
Yeah, that's for sure. It's been a crazy time. It's been a busy time, but we've been having a lot of fun.
You know, as I listen to your album, I really get a strong sense of somebody who's doing a lot of looking back, thinking about where he's landed and maybe what might have been lost.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of, the album is kind of a story arc of where I've been from being in my 20s and kind of being on the road all the time and just, pounding my feet against the sidewalk and my head against the wall a little bit. And it's a lot about relationships and specifically my relationship with my wife and kind of a lot of looking back and, seeing where I am now and having that perspective. You know, it's been a really great album to make for me personally, just to kind of dig deep into that stuff. And I feel really content right now, which is lovely.
I got dirt on my nails and a taxi coat. Maybe a little ragged, but I'm letting it go. Just give me a call and I'll be on the next train through. Honey, take your time, I'm always gonna be here for you.
There are certain songs that you can't write when you're 20.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. And I think it's, for me, this is the first kind of album of songs about love. You know, it's something that I kind of strayed away from when I was starting to write, because I felt like everybody writes about, and it's a hard thing to find, I think, your unique voice in that, in that concept. And so it took me a while to get there. So I wrote a lot of murder ballads, a lot of songs about death and dismemberment, and now we're here.
Now it's time. And then talk to us a little about working with producer Steve Berlin of Los Lobos, because I find it interesting to kind of get a sense of the what happens in the give and take between artist and producer once you're working in the studio, and like how much of what we hear on that album is you and how much is Steve?
That's a great question. Steve, let me start by saying that Los Lobos has been a huge influence on my music for a really long time. They're kind of, heroes as far as American music goes, and the way that they have kind of synthesized a lot of different forms of roots music is just, to me, is amazing and really speaks to me. And so to have him working on the album was a real honor. It's the first time that I worked with a producer on one of my solo records. Usually I produce my records myself. And so that was a big leap for me, because I'm kind of a control freak when it comes to my stuff. And I don't think I would have trusted a lot of other hands in the mix. But it was a lot of back and forth. There was some conflict. There was some meeting in the middle. We both had a lot of very strong ideas. And he's like my grumpy Jewish uncle, it's like family, he's really, we got along really well and we kind of spoke the same language, and his ear is absolutely incredible. And a lot of the stuff he does in the studio was mind blowing to me. And so I think it was a pretty fair mix of, my ideas and his ideas and then what the band can do and kind of working on stuff in the studio. A lot of the songs really evolved as we got deeper into them. So it was a really great process, but it was also a process where I had to give up some control, which was tough. So it was challenging in a lot of ways.
The first track on this album, I think, will be something that, I don't know, I think a lot of people can relate to, Just Getting By, when you're singing about your childhood, when everything was fresh and exciting, colors a little brighter, and then you sing, there's something that I lost along the way, there's something we lose in every day.
There were days, I swear there were, when the colors were a little brighter, dodging cars on handlebars, my heart could have been lighter, as the sun settled down for long nights of rest. Street lights came on and I tried to do my best to get on home, to get on home, to get on home before my mother called my name.
What is that something that we lose when we're just getting by?
Yeah, I think that this song in particular is kind of a tough one to put a finger on, because if you kind of listen to it at surface level, it's a little dark in some ways. But the root of this song is that it's kind of about those moments in life, those sweet little moments. It's kind of about finding the beauty in the ordinary and finding that kind of rhythms in your life as you get to past your 20s and into your 30s and stuff, where you're kind of finding a rhythm, and it's about finding the sweetness in there. And there's a lot of the kind of highs and lows, the extremes that get tempered a little bit, I think, when you get a little bit older and have some more perspective, and not everything is always this high drama. And so I think that's kind of what I'm talking about, is those moments of extreme highs and lows, and those moments of, you know, ecstatic joy, and those moments of desperate longing and terrible loneliness. And that stuff all kind of gets a little, you know, toward the middle more. And so I've grown to really appreciate the beauty in these ordinary moments. And I think that that's what, you know, mostly life is filled with.
Speaking of really finding that joy in the everyday, I have to tell you, Joshua, one of my favorite tracks on your new album is The Little Things, which is the song not about that first blast and heat of falling in love. This is a song for people who have really put in some time together.
It's the way you catch the light when the sun is going down. It's the way you shake your head when I'm acting like a clown. It's the way that you don't care when your hair falls in your face. As long as it's next to you, go on and put me in my place. It's the little things you do that keep me up all night. It's the little things you say, it's gonna be alright. And every time I go away, every time I roam, honey, it's the little things that make me hurry back.
Do you find it difficult, or is it cathartic writing something that is really, really personal for someone really close to you, like your wife?
You know, I'm a very private person in general. That's why I have such a hard time with social media. But this album is filled with stuff like that. I mean, it's very personal songs. And yeah, it is kind of putting yourself out there. You know, I mean, that's why in the past I've written a lot of songs, you know, that were inspired by other people's lives, and in a lot of ways. And so this album hits home, you know, in a very real way, and it, in a very kind of transparent way. And yeah, that song is just that. It's about the reasons that I'm excited to get back home, and it's about these little pieces of our lives that should be treasured. And sometimes I think we just walk past those and kind of, you know, plod through the day and don't kind of soak that in. And other days, we have those days where we're really appreciating those moments. And those are the days that I really treasure.
Now that you've gotten that national exposure through being on The Voice, you know, you're playing around and the country, and there you were, you know, competing with other artists. You were working with Blake Shelton and Adam Levine. I'm wondering, do you have a sense of something that sets Midwestern singer-songwriters like you or like Laith Alsati apart from other regions of the country?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I grew up in the folk realm, and I grew up going to a lot of music festivals around Michigan. That's kind of where my music came from, was Wheatland and Hiawatha and Blissfest, and then we went to, my mom took me to Heart Plaza a lot in Detroit, and we went to all the, you know, music festivals there. And that sense for music being about community and about collaboration and not about one-upping the other person, that sense is really deeply in our music here in the Midwest, and specifically in Michigan. You know, I am part of an artist collective called Earthwork Music, and it's just a network of artists that kind of have this you know, this back and forth, and this, you know, we're kind of always bouncing ideas off each other and building something as a whole rather than trying to get ahead yourself. And I think that's what kind of sets it apart. It's that spirit of community and spirit of collaboration, and music being by and for the people, and also very value-based music. I mean, a lot of us, you know, myself included, partner with organizations that are in line with our values, and we use the skills that we have to kind of push forward the things that in our society, in our world, that mean a lot to us.
Well, it's a wonderful album. I want to congratulate you on it. It is very, very personal, very, very much from the heart. And it's the kind of music you want to listen to get yourself in a happier frame of mind driving home after a tough day.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you saying that.
It's wonderful. You can get all the details on upcoming performances and the album The Way Back Home by going to joshuadavismusic.com. Joshua Davis, best of luck with the album, and thank you so much for spending time with us today on Stateside.
Thanks, Cynthia. I really appreciate it.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs.
Grandpa worked nights, always short on time. Never missed a shift unless they were out on that picket line. Grandma did nails in a little shop to make ends meet for a while. Smelled like acetone when she got home, but she always wore a smile. I know the money was tight, I know the time was tighter, but like a woman in the twilight, and each step looked a little bit lighter. You gotta cleave it up every night, every day. If you don't keep showing up, honey, it's gonna fade away. Here's to making that good love last. Here's to making that good love last.
Coming up next, looking back at the long, complicated history of Native American boarding schools in Michigan.
The idea is to found these Indian boarding schools where Indian children will basically not be allowed to be Indian children anymore.
That's after the break. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
The United Nations considers a war stopped even more important than a war won.
If our cities go down, in my opinion, our nation will go down.
You have to think about your dream and what you want to do.
All we were trying to do was just get music for all people.
You've probably heard that phrase, school of choice, used when describing public education options in Michigan. But what about a school of no choice? Such was the case for many Native Michiganders. It's Wednesday, which means it's time to talk about our state's history with our partners at the Michigan History Center. With November being Native American History Month, pleasure to welcome Eric Hemingway, Director of Archives and Records for the Little Traverse Bay Bands of Odawa Indians, and the Director of the Michigan History Center, Sandra Clark. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Eric, before we break down the school of no choice, would you describe for us what Odawa education looked like as Europeans first began arriving in Michigan?
Odawa education was very community-based, very land-based, a lot of interaction between tribal elders and the youth as people started to transition into elder status within communities and they couldn't perform a lot of the hard duties of hunting, fishing, and gardening. They would pass that knowledge on to the youth. So there's a lot of interaction between uncles, aunts, grandmas, and grandpas with a lot of the children of the community.
And Sandra, how did things start to change after the War of 1812?
Well, the War of 1812 is really that last chance that the Native people have to find allies to fight what turns out to probably be inevitable, which is the settlement that the United States brings with it. You have real pressures on Native people. The term used was to become civilized, and civilized meant that you were Christian, that you went to school, and that you farmed.
So as things began to change, Eric, we want to focus on Harbor Springs. How did these changes play out on the ground in Harbor Springs?
Up in Harbor Springs, a big push was education. Education was seen as a tool not only to civilize natives, but then the Odawa flipped it and said, well, we're going to use this to combat all the changes that are going to occur to our communities. So they were preemptive, and they started to educate their youth in Western standards very early. And one of those methods that they used was sending them to schools down in Cincinnati, seminary schools, but they also worked with the local church to build a mission school in conjunction with their community. They were being taught in their native language of Anishinaabemowin, and as technology progressed, they were actually printing materials in their native language. But this would be deemed uncivilized, it would be deemed savage by later standards, and that would stop by the 1880s.
Sandra, how did things shift again with this change of attitude in the 1880s? What was going on?
In the 1880s, now you're past the Civil War, and this is the time when you have the Indian genocide, I think it's fair to call it, in the western part of the United States. You have armed conflict between the United States and Native people. And one of those Army people manages, takes some Apache to Florida. He cuts their hair. He makes them wear uniforms and act like white people. He says this is the way you'll save the Indians. If you don't like what's happening in the West, take the Indian out of the Indian. And so the idea is to found these Indian boarding schools where Indian children will basically not be allowed to be Indian children anymore.
And Eric, how did that focus on, and I'm going to use air quotes here, civilizing Odawa students, how did that play out? And what were the conditions of the schools like?
Well, this idea of civilizing natives was widespread. And the individual that Sandra is referring to is Richard Pratt. And he has an infamous quote of, to save the man, you have to kill the Indian. And so the system that they deemed the best way to do this was the Indian boarding schools. And the boarding schools varied from community to community, but we had one here up in Harbor Springs. It started out as a mission school that was in conjunction with the tribe and the local Catholic Church. But as federal policies dictated Indian education into the 1880s, the policy said that Indian language was forbidden, Indian dress was forbidden. So when these kids were going to these schools, they were forbidden to speak their language, they were forbidden to practice their traditions, and in a lot of cases, they were forbidden to interact with their siblings or their kin. These schools sometimes were for 1 or 2 years, but sometimes they were for several, and some of the kids actually went to schools outside of their communities. So we had kids from Harbor Springs who went down to Carlisle, Pennsylvania, Genoa, Kansas, and they would be at these schools for 4, 5, 6 years at a time.
What kind of education did these children get?
Well, the education primarily for these children was that of being a laborer. They were not training these children to go into higher ed to be lawyers or doctors. They were expected to go right into the labor force as maids, nannies, carpenters, work in a printing press. So that was really the goal of the education, but also to teach them to read and to write, uneducate them on being Odawa. That was as equally a mission of these schools as educate them in a Western standard. So when these kids were at the school, if they spoke their language, they were reprimanded in many different ways, either physically or emotionally. So to deprogram them out of their Indian mindset and to program them into a Western mindset was happening simultaneously.
Sandra, by the 1920s, views about these schools shifted again. How so?
They were very, very expensive. So you're just coming out of the First World War. The federal government is paying for bringing these children up, for their housing, their clothing, all of those things. So there is a expense reason to cut the budget and to close the schools. And the threat from Native people is perceived in a very different way than it was when the schools were first started. I don't think that their stopping doing it had a lot to do with people looking around and saying, gosh, we really shouldn't be doing this. But it simply was a very expensive thing and perhaps not needed anymore.
Were they all closed down, or, Eric, did the school in Harbor Springs outlast the others?
It did. And once the granddaddy of all the schools, Carlisle, closed, I believe in 1924, a lot of other schools just started to follow suit. As Sandra said, a lot of this was due to funding. These were expensive to run. They had to house the kids, feed them, clothe them, pay for staff, and so on and so forth. So when the funding started to dry up, so did the schools. But what makes Holy Childhood an anomaly is that it keeps going for another 60 years. It doesn't close until 1983, and it's the last Indian boarding school to do so.
I think you can hear jaws drop. I don't think many people realize that was going till 1983. Ultimately, what happened? What led to its closing?
Once again, funding. Once the government started to pull funding from these schools in the 20s and 30s, Holy Childhood managed to keep its own fundraising efforts going. And by the 40s and 50s, a lot of kids started to transition into the public schools up here in Harbor Springs, but some still went to the boarding school. And a large number of Odawa from the Little Traverse community and other communities as well went to that boarding school up until the 50s and 60s and sometimes the 70s.
We open this segment by using a phrase from an article, Eric, that you wrote for the Historical Society of Michigan. Why do you call these schools that are intended for Native people School of No Choice?
I use that title because when you look at the history of these schools, these Native children all across the country had no choice to be themselves. They had no choice to pursue their indigenous beliefs, their indigenous language and culture. And this foreign alien system of thinking was imposed on them at a very early age. At the critical fundamental years of development, they were taking these kids from their homes and their community structure and putting them into these oftentimes abusive, abrasive, harsh environments. And it was not by their choice. The repercussions of these schools are still felt very strongly to this day in Native communities all through North America and Canada included.
Spell that out for us. What kind of lasting impact has it had on Native communities?
Loss of language, I think, is one of the biggest impacts. When these kids were at the school, they were forbidden to speak their language. And loss of culture, tradition, spiritual beliefs, community ties, family skills. And we hear devastating stories of kids who survived the school and they grew up to be our elders. And, you know, they talk about the situations they went through and how that affected their ability to raise children and develop relationships with other people because of what happened to them at the boarding schools.
It is certainly a key part of Michigan's history, isn't it, Sandra?
It is, and I think it's a key part to understanding a lot of things that happen today. As Eric has said, this is a generational trauma. It's not something that dies with the people who lived through it, who were told that their culture had no value. You see the effects of it still today, and if you don't understand that, sometimes you have a hard time understanding what Native people are saying or why they are taking various positions and why they don't trust some of our Euro-American institutions.
Sandra Clark, director of the Michigan History Center, and Eric Hemenway, director of Archives and Records for the Little Traverse Bay Bands of Odawa Indians. Thanks to both of you for educating us on this very long, complicated history of Native American schooling in Michigan. It was great talking with you.
Thank you. It was enjoyable.
Thank you very much.
Imagine being a sleepy little kid driving home late at night with Dad. You kind of drop off to sleep, but you're awake enough to feel your dad scoop you up, carry you into the house, and gently tuck you into bed. Now, imagine that Dad is NHL legend Gordie Howe, and he's tucking you in just a short time after thrilling thousands of Detroit Red Wings fans cheering for Mr. Hockey at Olympia Stadium. That little boy grew up to be physician Murray Howe. His new book is 9 Lessons I Learned from My Father, giving us a son's eye view of Gordie Howe, one of the most beloved and one of the best players ever to lace up a pair of hockey skates. Dr. Murray Howe, it is great to have you with us.
Oh, it's absolutely great to be here. Thank you so much, Cynthia.
You had me misty-eyed, I'm going to tell you right now, by page 4 as you describe that late-night tuck-in. You bring us so many personal and intimate stories of your dad and your family. Why was it important for you to do that through this book, Murray?
I really felt that Dad was just such an inspiration to so many. In fact, when he passed away, I was so blown away by the outpouring of love and admiration for this man. I always knew that he was loved, but when we were at Joe Louis Arena and the 15,000 fans were there for 13 hours, I just heard story after story of how much he meant to them, and it just blew me away, and I got to think more about him and what was it that made him so different. And as I drilled down into it, I realized that he just was a really unusual person, that he gave so much of himself, kind of like my mom did as well, and people responded to that. They understood and felt his caring and his love, and so as I realized how special he was after he passed, I really wanted to share that with the rest of the world to keep his spirit going and his legacy of love.
What are some of the adjectives that you believe best describe Gordie Howe?
Wow. Humble, for sure. Generous, gracious, courageous, loving, unstoppable.
There's some great adjectives there. I love the way you've structured your book as your process of kind of writing his eulogy as you muse about his life after he passed on June 10th, 2016. You share so many very personal family stories in your book. And I'm just, will you tell us the one about how Gordie Howe got his very first pair of skates when he was just 6 years old during the Depression in Saskatchewan?
Yes, this is one of my favorite stories of all time, and I never get tired of telling it or of reading it to readers, because it is so beautiful. So in the Depression era in Saskatoon, really nobody had two nickels to rub together. It was 50 below zero. They had no indoor plumbing, no indoor heating, and it was a pretty meager existence. But, you know, people had each other, and that was really important, and especially in a place like Saskatoon, a farming community, they really banded together. And late one night, there's a knock at the door in the middle of the winter, and it was a neighbor woman who her husband was ill and could not work, and she had a newborn, and they didn't have any money for food or for milk for her baby. And so she said, I really hate to beg, but I am just wondering if you could buy this burlap sack that I have of stuff, and I would just be eternally grateful, so I just have enough money, you know, for my child. And my grandmother was just one of the most incredibly generous and beautiful women on earth, and even though she didn't have much, she went around the house and scrounged around all the money that she literally had, which was $1.50, and she gave it to her, and then gave her a bag of food and vegetables that she had saved from her garden. The woman was eternally grateful, and my grandmother took the burlap sack inside and she poured it out, and it was mostly junk, but there was one pair of skates that fell out, and my dad saw those skates, and the rest is history. He wore those skates for 4 years. He was 6 years old at the time. They were his first pair of skates, and he wore them till he was 10. And it was those skates that really launched the career of the world's greatest hockey player.
And I'll just tell everybody, your book is packed with wonderful stories like that. You and your brothers played hockey growing up, and of course Mark and Marty went on to become professional hockey players. Not quite so much for you. And you write that being, in your words, unceremoniously axed from the University of Michigan Wolverines was the best thing that ever happened to you. Why did you say that, and what did your dad say when that happened?
Well, I had dedicated my entire life to being a professional hockey player. When I was born into the Howe family, our entire house was just a shrine to hockey. I mean, we had hockey equipment everywhere, and our walls were decorated with just trophies and hockey paintings and pictures. And, of course, not only was Dad a pro, but my brothers, even when they were young, were just amazing hockey players. And so I just assumed that that's what I was supposed to do. And, of course, I loved playing. I loved feeling like I was following my dad's footsteps. And I ended up playing in Detroit and then in Toronto. I played with Gretzky and Paul Coffey. And so I did everything possible to make it. But when I tried out for Michigan, I just didn't make the grade. I just lacked talent. That was the main thing. I was so crushed, because this had been my whole life, that I couldn't even wish the players, you know, good luck. And so I just wrote on the board, good luck, guys, and walked out into a brave new world. And I thought, wow, now what am I going to do with my life? And I walked back to my dorm at Bursley Hall and called my parents. And the first thing they said was, well, thank God we don't have to worry about you anymore.
Oh, my goodness.
And they were so supportive. And they just said, Murray, you know, we just want you to be happy, and we want you to do whatever, you know, whatever your passions and dreams are, and follow those. So it took all the pressure off, and I loved sciences, and so I had a pre-med curriculum, which I wasn't sure how I was going to pull that off playing hockey anyway. So it made it easier for me to be able to pursue that, and I was fortunate to get into University of Michigan Medical School, and so that paved the way for my career, and I'm so thankful that I was able to find something that I love as much as my father loved hockey.
Well, I'm going to tell you, we could talk for hours about what's in your book, but I'm going to say that I loved Nine Lessons I Learned from My Father by Murray Howe, who will be speaking about his book tomorrow afternoon, 4 p.m. at Hockey Town Cafe on Woodward, right next to the Fox Theater. Also, he will be at the National Writers Series in Traverse City this coming Sunday, November 12th at 7 p.m., and other appearances. For details, just go to penguinrandomhouse.com and search for Murray Howe. Dr. Murray Howe, your book is wonderful. Thank you so much for being with us on Stateside.
Oh, it was such a privilege and an honor, and wonderful to talk with you, Cynthia. Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Ellie Billings and engineered by Bob Scon. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Danny Henzo, Sarah Leeson, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks so very much for listening.